Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
We acknowledge the Yuggera and Kaurna nations as traditional custodians of the land on which we work, live and learn, and their continuing connection with the land, waters and community. We pay our respects to them and their elders past and present.
All content related to this program is for general informational purposes only and contains stories and discussions around mental health that may be disturbing to some listeners. If you are concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional individual advice and support. More details are contained in our show notes.
This week, in Once Upon a Time Travel, 2002 Lonely Louise is visited by the ghost of future self at New Year's.
Okay, everyone, before I drop some more sick beats, grab your New Year's partner for that midnight pash. And if you can't find your own partner, borrow somebody else's.
Pash me, Mr. DJ!
Whoa, looks like someone's on the prowl for their New Year's resolution.
Pucker up and taste, baby! New Year's!
Didn't I see you vomiting earlier? Not sure I want to be tasting any of that, thank you, ma'am.
You wish you could taste this.
30 seconds. Get those glasses ready.
What? Who the fuck are you?
I'm the ghost of Louise Future, and I've come to let you know it gets better.
Get off it, lady. I'm not into chicks.
Well, I've got some news for you there.
What do you want?
I just want to let you know that even though tonight you're going to end up crying in the gutter and drunk dialing your unrequited crush at 3 a.m, future you knows her value and has found people who see her for who she is. You don't have to pretend to be someone you're not anymore.
Happy New Year! hey, happy New Year! Hey, happy New Year! Happy New Year! Oi, happy New Year! Hey there!
Look at you two.
Happy New Year! Come here. No? Ah, Happy New Year! Not you either. Okay.
Louise?
I just want someone of my own to pash. Why won't somebody love me?
They will. And more importantly, you'll love yourself. I'm just going to slip away now, but please don't do anything silly. Meanwhile, back in 1991, younger repressed Andy is interrupted in the middle of something.
Oh, hi.
Andy Pandy, what's your dandy?
just trying to get some study done. Got a major SAG next week and I haven't started writing it yet. It's all up here, you know.
You'll shit it in. You always do. Hey, come down to the uni bar tonight. The Doors cover band's playing.
Nah, I really need to...
Vanessa will be there. She really likes you.
Who are you? Hey, the ghost of Andy Future. I'm you in about 30 years' time. I knew that weed floating around the dorm was affecting me. Nah, I'm just here to tell you to relax. Have a bit of fun. Life doesn't have to be so serious. But I really don't feel like going out to the bar. It's just full of loud drunk people.
Dude, I'm you and it's the early 90s and I know exactly why you don't want to risk losing your inhibitions.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've got a mountain of study to do and I don't have time for a girlfriend.
Fine, but you don't have to drink to be included. People love your sense of humour and who you are regardless.
I just feel like I don't fit in.
And you're going to realise why in 2 years' time when you get a massive crush on a guy in one of your classes and write him a love letter with the lyrics to I Honestly Love You.
Oh. So does that work out?
Nah. But you find someone much better for yourself. You've got a whole life ahead of you, my friend. You won't get this part of your life back again, so just put the books down for one night and go out with your friends. You don't have to drink.
Just come out for one drink.
Okay, I think I'll pass on the drink, but yeah, I would love to come anyway.
Cool. See you at 7.
Next time, in Once Upon a Time Travel, more people ignore their future selves and make the same choices anyway.
You know, Andy, I don't think that past me would have listened to current me if I'd zapped there.
Mm-mm, and I definitely wasn't ready to hear what current me would have had to say back then either.
Those scenes are very close to home, aren't they?
Yeah. And this is Reframe of Mind.
The podcast that cuts through the platitudes and gets to the core of living authentically, challenging our assumptions and improving mental health with the guidance of good science, philosophy and learning from other people's lived experiences.
We're your hosts, Andy Leroy and Louise Poole.
And I think we're on a bit of a hero's journey, I suppose you could say, Andy.
Yeah, we're definitely putting it all out there on the line in our quest to maintain good mental health.
Because unfortunately we don't have a time machine and we can't actually go back and change things. Got to start from where we are, which at the start of the podcast series was you'd recently lost your father to cancer and I'd ended my 20-year radio career.
So we've been looking at the traumas of adjusting to our new world and we've covered quite a bit of ground in trying to find a way to relate differently to the world.
One in which we love and value ourselves.
Yeah, and honour ourselves with strong boundaries when it comes to living our values. But sometimes it's something more than conversation and perspective alone doesn't fix it.
Yes. Last episode, we had a pretty in-depth conversation with Professor Marie Thiessen AC. She's the director of the Matilda Centre for Research in Mental Health and Substance Use on Mental Health and Addiction.
Yeah, and because she gave us so much information, we thought it would be great just to break it down a little bit and refer back to some of those points and just look at it from our current perspective. You know, as people will often tell me, hindsight is a wonderful thing. Mm-hmm. So, you know, hopefully in this case, our hindsight might help someone who is now where we were about 18 years ago.
You know, I've often thought if I could have a conversation with me from 18 plus years ago, what things I would say, what advice I would give them. Honestly, I don't know if I would listen.
Yeah, it's one of those things that crops up pretty often on social media, isn't it? Like, if you could say three words to your 20-year-ago self, what would they be? I mean, I know the things that are important to me now, but
like
honestly,
invest in Apple.
What's Apple? Like, it's at that stage, it would have been like the old record label that the Beatles had. It wouldn't have even kind of hit the radar. Well, they had computers, I suppose. But, you know, I just don't think that we can necessarily think that if we'd had that information then that we would have actually acted differently. But, you know, who knows? You never know, do you?
Good news is, though, that past me actually would have listened to somebody else talk about the subject and actually gone, oh, that's a good point, even though I would have thought that future me was full of shit. So hopefully, because we're actually not talking to past Louise and Andy, someone actually might get some value out of this one before they have to go down the future us paths themselves.
Fingers crossed.
I think that I confused that as much as a time travel paradox.
Well, let's hop straight back into the subject matter that we have with Marie. And when we're talking about substances, what do we mean?
I think most commonly there's things like alcohol or cigarettes. We say drugs a lot, and that obviously has a few different meanings.
Yeah. So, you know, I mean, I've been a smoker in the past and we've all had a drink, or I say all, but we can't always make that generalization. But, you know, sometimes the substances aren't legal, but they're the ones that can have monstrous effects on people and the people who love them.
And often the people around us are suffering in silence, as Marie pointed out when she spoke about how long it takes for people to ask for help.
People do run into problems with alcohol. There's a sense of shame and stigma, and it's just devastating. We see for people who have problems with alcohol, it can take up to 18 years before they'll talk to anyone about those problems. That can mean they can start to have problems when they're 18 or 19, and they really wait until their mid-30s before they say to a GP or to a friend, hey, I think I'm, you know, this is really interfering with my life and maybe I need to do something about this. But that can take 18 years.
Now, Andy, I know that I have thus far, 15 episodes into Reframe of Mind, received a lot of free therapy from our guests. Not afraid to... not afraid to milk it for my own free therapy.
You've got to put it out there. And if they're willing, why wouldn't you?
And Marie is exceptionally qualified.
And very giving.
Why not try and get my free therapy from Marie?
Why not?
As I had the audacity to compare my depression and anxiety with addiction to substances. But that thing that she said about the research around it taking people 18 plus years to ask for help really struck a chord.
It's a long time, isn't it? Like, we don't think of that lead up time, or people, I guess, suffering for so long. Are they suffering as much in the beginning as they are at that 18 year point? Don't know, but it is a long time when you think about it.
Frog in the pot. It's what I say. You know, it starts off with something small. It's like, I can handle this. Next thing you know, time's gone by, the pot's boiling and the frog's just in there chilling. Like, you don't realise how much of the heat has turned up and how bad of a situation you're in until it starts to affect your life.
Yeah.
I have a goldfish memory. You know this.
Yeah, I do. Every day I'm reminded. Either by you saying I've got a goldfish memory or you're forgetting something, but I'm reminded.
I think the goldfish probably have better memories than me. That's how bad it is. I'm really good at remembering obscure bits of information and the overall concept and feelings of stuff. Not so great at remembering things that maybe I've done or we've experienced. Or often I will hear a story from somebody telling me something that I've done in the past and I think, oh, yeah, that sounds like something I'd do.
Whereas I can probably quote somebody verbatim from 25 years ago.
And so it's handy to have you around, Andy, because we work together in Darwin and you can remind me of things. Like, did you actually smoke then?
Yeah, I did. I was a smoker back then, 2009. Yeah, I was probably at the peak of my smoking habit. So I would have been on maybe, roughly a pack a day is kind of where I averaged at, I'd say.
Like hearing it for the first time, honestly, I can't remember you ever smoking. You
would've... All of those breakfasts that we had down at Cullen Bay and I dragged out the ashtray and before the meal came.
Nah, gone from my memory, which is good because now I can interview you like I've never heard the story.
Go for it. Is this my therapy time? This is my therapy session?
Yeah. Well, okay. I don't charge as much as Marie, I imagine. I mean.
Well, you better not.
Okay. So, when did you start smoking?
Okay. There's a couple of tiers to this answer because I tried to start smoking and then I actually was successful in starting smoking because it does take practice, you know.
It's a skill. One that is best not learned.
The first time I thought that I would actually like to become a smoker was when I was in university. And okay, so I'm going to have a bit of the goldfish effect here. And I can't remember whether it was my first year or my third year, my final year. I think it was my final year of uni. Pretty sure. That would have been about 94, about 1994, when I thought, oh, fuck it, I'm just going to have a smoke.
Was that stress related? Do you think there was so much going on that you thought it would, or was that kind of a everybody else is doing it situation?
Yeah, it wasn't what everybody else was doing, definitely, because I don't think I knew a lot of smokers. I knew a couple of smokers, but I didn't feel inclined to want to kind of join a peer group with it. For me, in 1994, when I decided that I was going to try and smoke, was me actually coming to the conclusion that I didn't want to be here anymore. And if smoking was one way to die, then I might as well add that to the list of possibilities.
Mm.
So I remember sitting down by one of the lakes on the university campus and rolling myself a cigarette thinking, oh, well, here's a nail on the coffin.
It's very
sad. Sounds very dramatic, doesn't it?
Yes, that's... I'm sorry.
Just smoke myself to death.
I'm sorry you ever felt that way. That's not a nice place to have been.
No, it's not a nice place to have been. Clearly, I'm okay with it now, talking about it. But if I think back to that period and what led me to that end point of why I decided to then reach for a cigarette because I wanted to kill myself, what a silly way to do it. But anyway, people do kill themselves every day with cigarettes. Mm. So I guess what led me to that was, you know, a big picture of me not being myself, me feeling like I had to be somebody else, me feeling excluded in some way or other. But also, you know, within that, me excluding myself from situations for different reasons. You know, that sketch at the beginning of today's episode, you know, with young Andy and older Andy and that sort of thing, like that was me. That was me saying, look, you know, I haven't got time for a girlfriend, telling my grandmother, haven't got time for a girlfriend because I've got too much study.
Study. Is that why you didn't have time for a girlfriend, is it?
That's well, that's what he maintained. That's what I maintained at that age. Mm. So there's all of that kind of underlying stuff there that made me really not value myself to the point where I thought, I'll have a smoke. I'm going to have a smoke. But I didn't actually succeed. So I think I got through one and thought, oh, actually, that's fucking disgusting and I actually don't want to smoke. Didn't fix the actual underlying issue, mind you, but then kind of put the tobacco away as a stupid idea and just kind of persevered.
All right, so 1994, you took up smoking briefly and then you stopped again.
Yeah,
you
yeah, were
if you were smoking when we were in Darwin, then there's more story.
Oh, yeah, there's definitely more.
Well, what's so, the story?
Well,
tell me about the worst times in your life. Louise is listening.
This is the second tier of the story of Andy Starts Smoking, where in 1995, I had come out of the closet, as we colloquially say, when homosexuals decide to declare to the world they're homosexual, because that's what everybody does. Because hello, I'm heterosexual. Woohoo!
Because you didn't have time for a girlfriend, so you found a boyfriend instead.
Found a boyfriend instead. So anyway, 1995, I actually had finished my course. I graduated. So towards the end of my final year of uni, I was starting to experiment and I was starting to get in touch with that part that touches me, that kind of thing.
Oh, really? This is the precursor to Andy's sexy slutty times from episode 5, I think.
Some years before. Actually, when you met me, I was kind of at the tail end of that. But anyway, I digress. So 1995, I'm processing a lot emotionally and a lot personally, because for me, how it panned out was, okay, well, I came out to myself. And, you know, as a lot of people who go through the coming out process will tell you, you find people to test the safety of it with. So I had a friend at the time who had recently come out himself. So he was a pretty safe bet that I could say, hey, by the way, me too, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And then I found a few more people, but nobody in my family, because, you know, we've talked about that in previous episodes, how being gay wasn't okay. And that was very much kind of promoted in conversations. So I kind of had this sense that, you know, I needed to keep it quiet. But you can't keep it quiet. There comes a point where you've got to actually be true to yourself. And so 1995 was the year that I came out to my family. Whole other story. The smoking part of it, I met this guy and he was cute, man. He was sexy. Yeah, man.
He was 1995 sexy. So what did he look like? Like Jeremy Jordan or
he was a bit shorter than me. He had, you know, nice short hair. Like it wasn't a crew cut, but he had a nice style. And
did he look like a boy band member?
Not totally, but with a bit more attention probably could have. He had a really cute lantern jaw. Like he had a really cute square jawline and he was a great kisser.
Okay.
He was a really great kisser.
Yeah.
And for someone who has just met their first boyfriend, obviously he's the one and you're just kissing, kissing, kissing. Anyway, he was a smoker. You know, we'd be sitting in the back area, the piano bar at the Albury Hotel, which is a gay bar that's long closed down now. But, you know, we'd be smooching or whatever and, you know, spending time with our friends. But he would take a drag from his cigarette and then he would turn to me and kiss me, but he would actually then blow the smoke into my mouth. Romantic.
Sorry,
sexy.
Is that sexy? Because that sounds just fucking gross.
Well, I suppose it turned me on at the time.
Yep. I bet that, you know, and I bet you there's a category on Pornhub just for that.
I'm sure there is. haven't gone there. But the long and the short of it is then that introduced me very mildly to cigarette smoke.
Mildly, not in my system. It threw it right down your guts is what it did.
Well, yeah, it threw it right down my guts, but it also had already been in his guts. So it was diluted.
Pre-smoked smoke, yum.
Because passive smoke is, to me, not as strong as smoke directly from the pipe.
Would you call that passive, though? I'm going to call it
recycled smoke.
Yeah, it's not quite passive.
My point is, yes, it was gross.
Your point is, yes, you were gross, yes.
And also that the smoke didn't cut into my lungs the same way it does when you're taking it directly from the cigarette.
Again, I don't necessarily believe that to be fact. We'll have
you
to ask.
Try it.
We're going to have to.
You're going to have to try it.
One day we're going to talk to Marie again, and we're going to have to say Marie. Now,
okay.
As a hypothetical.
I know, but listen, like that was my experience
okay, yeah,
of
yeah,
it,
that
though.
Was, yeah, yeah,
so
know,
you know what I mean.
I know.
So for me, like
taking it so
didn't,
seriously.
I know, but you know, you've got to have your fun, but you've also got to, you know, I'm not being a scientist.
But that got you addicted again. That's when you picked it up for a second time.
Well,
yeah?
I hadn't been addicted, but what it did though was then, you know, over the course of time, because now I was in a peer group of smokers.
Mm.
So then someone would offer me a cigarette, and at first I declined, but then I thought, oh well, I'll try one. As you do, because I'd been primed with that secondhand smoke, it didn't have the same choking effect as it would have when I was trying it at the lake a year or so earlier. So then I started to become a smoker, and that's when I really started smoking. And then, you know, I met my first long-term partner after that guy, and he was a smoker. So, you know, we were two old smoking queens together, you know, we were just... Yeah. We'd wake up and have a cigarette, then have our morning coffee, that type of thing. It developed over time like that. It became a habit. I didn't consciously at the time when I was kissing that guy and receiving the smoke into my lungs via him think that I'd like to be a smoker. But the other things in the background there with the people that I was hanging out with and enjoying the company of, I felt like I wanted to be included in more ways. You know, like remember the year prior, I felt like I wasn't included. I didn't belong.
You try and quit? In that time?
Oh, God, no.
When did you first try to quit then?
That probably would have been probably late 90s. So we're talking mid-90s when I took it up. Always very conscious of how bad it is for me, though. So really kind of thinking, oh, I really don't want to do this, but I'm young.
Yeah, actually, that kind of, you know? The messaging around the quit campaigns of the late 90s was quite aggressive, I think. So
yeah. Yeah,
that's
yeah.
Even when I think they started to put the damage on the actual cigarette packets, isn't it? So every time you open it up, you see someone missing a hand.
That was late 90s from memory.
Mm.
So it wasn't long after I started, because what happened was when they introduced that, because nobody wanted to look at the gross amputated limbs or look at the lungs or look at the dying baby that was now on their cigarette packet, the cigarette companies would produce tins that didn't have those images on them but had their brand on it. So you'd buy the soft packs of the cigarettes and put them in the tin so that, you know, you had your nice sturdy case and you had your ciggies that didn't have the reminders of how bad they are for you.
And that's peak capitalism right there.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So now that you've found a way to not have to look at the lungs, the dying lungs on the front of the packets, did that help you quit? No.
No. So, you know, the motivation to quit came about because my parents weren't smokers.
Mm.
They didn't smoke. Or my dad smoked when I was quite young. He gave up in 1982. When I was about 11 years old. So Mum tried to have a smoke once, but then one day when I saw my grandmother, I said, yeah, Mum smokes, and then she never smoked again. I don't know why. When I was a smoker and I was with my first long-term partner, his parents were smokers, and we would observe how it was impacting their health. And they would try and quit every now and then. So it would go something like this, you know, like they'd both quit, say, yep, I've given up the smokes. Smokers cough and all that kind of stuff happening, so good time to give up. And then one of them would start sneaking cigarettes behind the other one's back and spray things around so that they wouldn't get busted, but they knew. And so it got to the point where they were both kind of cheating behind each other's back with the cigarettes. So one would go into the shed and have a cigarette, and one would go out to the front garden and have a cigarette. Neither of them acknowledging that they were smoking themselves, or that they knew the other ones were smoking, and then it all came out and they'd start smoking again. So, you know, all these funny little patterns that kind of happen in the people around us. You know, my partner and I at the time thought, okay, well, yeah, we should probably stop, because, you know, we don't want to kind of end up in bad health, you know, later years. So we decided to quit. And we tried a few times, but there's one time that does actually, like, hit my memory quite strongly. And we'd both given up together, and we were really, really happy with the money we were saving and the progress we'd made. We were about a month in, and I thought, I'm gonna buy us a reward CD. I'm gonna buy us some music as a celebration that we've got this far.
A reward CD. People used to play CDs, yeah?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, you think of the money you save, so you think, okay, well, with the money I would have smoked, I'm now buying this CD. It's a pretty common kind of quit tactic.
Doesn't that speak a lot for how much the price of cigarettes has gone up, though? Like, back then, a month of savings got you a CD, and now it probably gets you half a motorcycle.
Well, I don't know if it would have been a full month for a CD. But
was it part of a CD club, though?
No.
Maybe it got you a membership to a CD club.
No, not even that. Mm. It was just like me going, okay, well, this is something that I actually definitely wouldn't have purchased if I was smoking because I wouldn't have had enough money to do it.
Out with
but now
it.
But now I can buy this.
Who was
it? And
I can
do other stuff.
Come on. Out with it. It's going to be embarrassing, isn't it?
It was Katie Lang. She's a great artist. Sadly, the release that she had at the time was her CD called Drag, which, for anyone who doesn't know, is a CD full of songs that are about smoking, which I didn't actually realise. I kind of knew, but it didn't kind of click that that would be a bad idea to listen to a full CD's worth of songs about the joys and ups and downs of smoking. And my partner said to me, "You've bought us a CD about smoking," and within a week we were both back on them.
But, you know, props to you for supporting the lesbians of the 90s with,
totally. You know, I love Katie Lang. She's great. "All I need is the air that I breathe and to love you."
Was that on there?
Mm. Yeah.
Was there a song on the album about inhaling someone's secondhand smoke from a pash?
I don't think so.
So
I
it's
don't
not think it's so. Not a common thing then. It's not.
I don't think it's uncommon. I think there are certain places where you will find people blowing smoke into each other.
I do find certain places where people blow smoke up their asses. So okay. So you did try to quit, reward yourself with Katie Lang's Drag and then fail.
Yeah.
Okay, what was the success in Darwin then when you gave that up?
No, I didn't give up in Darwin. I was still smoking in Darwin. I continued smoking until 2012, by which time I'd met my current partner, who every time I lit a cigarette would go, "Ugh, yuck, you're disgusting. Stop it. Put it away. Yuck, I'm not sitting near you," all that kind of stuff, which actually also didn't motivate me to stop smoking.
No.
But
motivated you to hide it.
It motivated me to smoke away from him, definitely, because who needs that? But also contributing factors to helping me stop were things like I wasn't smoking inside like I was with my first partner. We would both smoke indoors. Oh, my God. When we moved out of our place that we were renting and we decided to clean a little patch on the wall, we actually ended up having to clean the whole room because that little patch was actually nicotine.
Oh.
And it exposed a really bright patch of the wall, which was really obvious.
All these things.
Don't smoke.
Yeah, all these things are
smoke.
Truly reinforcing my happiness at having never picked up smoking as a habit, to be honest.
Yeah, for sure. Be joyful. Be glad at that.
I can see how you easily fell into that pattern of becoming addicted to smoking. And I think I could have fell into that pattern of being addicted to smoking. It's not hard to be in that place. The only reason I think that smoking never appealed to me is because my father was a heavy smoker and he used to, well, I think he was a bit in that situation as well. He was constantly trying to quit. You know, Mum didn't let him smoke around the house or anything, so he'd have to kind of hide out at the back of the shed like it's his dirty little secret. And I noticed, like, in the ute he had sometimes, you know, there'd be, like, empty cigarette packets shoved underneath the seat and down behind it, like, hiding them. And he'd, you know, have a beer down in his shed and he'd smell, like, cigarettes and smoke and I think that combination for me, that smell of cigarettes, beer, and I think sweat, like sweaty man. Yeah.
I mean, you know, in certain circumstances. But
look, I've heard it does it for you earlier in the episode. But for me, any time I smell those things, particularly together, it makes me feel like I think I associate sometimes some of the negative experiences that I had as a kid and some of that trauma that we've discussed in previous episodes with that. And so I've never wanted to pick up smoking because it feels like that, and that's something that I didn't want to be.
So what about your friends at school and like through university or even through like working in radio?
Media,
like,
yes.
Because people love to have a smoke.
Yeah. I think I've been the odd one out in terms of that. I would say in my personal life, I probably, look, there's not many things that would be what I would call a deal breaker when it comes to relationships with people, whether they be friendships or romances. But honestly, smoking is probably one of them.
Mm.
Not saying I wouldn't have friends who smoke, but I definitely 100% wouldn't have a relationship with somebody who smokes. And that is purely because of that kind of PTSD around that for me, that smell.
Yeah. So any ladies listening, no smokers, please.
You know what? Like, I got the same problem with mustaches. So that's a whole different story. It's not. That's not why
we've never kissed.
It's not a childhood story. That goes back to a first relationship and maybe the subject of another podcast. But no, I also could not date somebody with a mustache. I'm sorry. It's not a reflection on you as a person. It's me. It's absolutely on me. Like, I do have a couple of good friends who smoke and I've just been honest with them with my boundaries. Like, one of my dear friends, he has tried to quit over the, 10 years or so I've known him, so many times, and he has done it, and he's been smoke-free for a year or so, and then a situation has come up and then I notice he's carrying around his little rollies again. I know he really wants to give it up. So for me to be around a friend like that, that's fine, because he respects my boundaries and will never make me sit in the same room and blow smoke in my face, He'll go out to the balcony, or he'll go out to the car park, and that's, it's fine.
Yeah. And look, there were times in between finally giving up that I was successful for maybe a year or so. I remember one job that I was in, I was particularly stressed in, and I had stopped smoking, but I decided one lunchtime to go down and buy some cigarettes and sit there at Circular Quay and have a smoke, because I couldn't deal with what was going on, and I didn't want to be there. Like, it came down to that. I just don't want to be here. What's my quickest escape? It wasn't a suicidal ideation at that point. It was actually, fuck it, I can't deal with this. What's my best route of escape? My best route of escape is just to zone out with a cigarette and, allow the chemicals to do whatever they did to me to relax me.
It's interesting that you should identify smoking as a coping mechanism.
Mm.
Marie told us about a model that she came up with for personality types and how their coping strategies might make them actually more prone to addiction.
One way of thinking about this is Harry Potter. For me, you've got the shyness and the awkwardness in Hermione. You've got that sort of more negative thinking, more seeing the doom and gloom in the world, if you think about Ron Weasley. And the third set in the triumvirate is Harry. And Harry's a go-getter. He's a sensation seeker. And that's the third group of ways of thinking about teenagers. And the fourth group is more the impulsive kids. And I think Voldemort or Tom Riddle is the most impulsive kid you can imagine.
Okay, so going by Marie's model here, I'm definitely a Ron,
You worry wart?
I know. Mum used to call me that all the time when I was growing up. Oh, you're just worrying again. You're a worry wart. The worry juju does run pretty strong. So it's no surprise that I was a smoker for, on and off, here's the magic number, 17 years.
Yeah, close to that 18 years, definitely.
Yeah, yeah.
I reckon I'm relating hard to Hermione.
yeah.
I mean, I guess you would say now I'm not shy and awkward. Well, actually, no, you'd still say I'm awkward now for sure, but maybe not shy. But certainly when I was in the adolescence, the young adult ages, I would describe myself as a bit shy, definitely awkward. That's never changed. It's just perhaps my awkwardness has become a little bit more popular. Quirkiness is cool now, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And also Hermione had a cat.
Yeah, she did. So, Ron had a rat though, so have you got a rat?
I've got a cat called Mouse. Does that count?
Ron had a rat that was actually a human.
Yeah, I haven't got one of those. Yeah, so what I'm if you're, a bit behind the game.
What if your cat called Mouse is secretly an old man called Fred?
You know what? Sometimes I think he is, because I bust him regularly sitting on my chair on the front porch. I'll go out there and he's like lazing back and he looks up at me like, yeah, what do you want?
Mm.
I think I might actually have a cat called Mouse that is a human.
Called Fred.
Called Fred.
An old man called Fred.
Yeah.
He's an old man called Fred. That's not one of Marie's characters, though, in working out personality types.
We can pitch it to her next time. Maybe she can do a whole Flintstones model.
I think we all have a little bit of Voldemortness, though, a little bit of that impulsive Tom Riddle, although we haven't really tried to
kill everybody in
a massive wizard fight.
I'd like to think that all of us have got a little bit of all of those things in there, but like what Marie's getting at is that these trays are kind of, and I say trays because
you
Marie
just
says
say trays. I know you say,
I always say traits.
I normally say traits too, but trays is the correct way of saying it.
I think trays is actually the correct way. I'm going to defer to Marie on this one.
It's no surprise that Marie is smarter than us, I suppose.
Oh, well, no self-dumping then.
No.
but, no, I think that her model is great in highlighting that, you know, there are certain traits that actually do become more prominent in us, you know. Like, I was a known worrier, so it's useful to be able to say, okay, well, look, you know, young Andy over there worries a lot, so he might be prone to doing this. He might be prone to becoming a smoker because could quite easily become addicted to that habit that one reason or another soothes him.
Or maybe young Louise, who was a little bit shy and awkward, needed a drink for social lubrication.
I know. And, you know, like the 1990s, that was a binge drinker's dream.
Or nightmare.
Yeah, like I suppose we were both drinking in the same era, even though we're 10 years apart. Like
close to the same era. 90s Andy would have been drinking, but I actually think it's more like 2001 Louise that probably started drinking. So,
oh, okay. You were very late 90s.
Yeah,
then.
You were drinking to maybe MC Hammer, and I was drinking to Britney Spears. That's the difference.
I was binge drinking to Groovers in the Heart.
Okay, yeah. Here's the question that will separate us. What was your first nightclubbing song?
Jeez, that's a really hard question because I'm not a nightclubber.
Okay.
So we're talking, talking early 90s. Mm. I want to keep throwing back to Groovers in the Heart, but that was a couple of years later, you know, like. Yeah.
Or not even necessarily a nightclub song, but you know how we link emotion and memory. And okay, so when I first started learning to drive, I felt like every time I got in the car, the Mighty Mighty Boss Tones, the impression that I get was on. And so every time I hear that song now, I remember learning to drive.
Yeah, you know, I don't feel like I have that kind of link. I mean, I've got very strong links to music and lyrics and stuff growing up and through my early adulthood and stuff like that. But you saying that, I can't think of a similar kind of connection.
Because the ones that I associate with those first times of going out drinking, nightclubbing, the when you hear this, when the song comes on, you're like, this is my jam, yeah. It's like the Venga Boys.
Uh-huh.
And Anne Lee's Two Times.
Right. Actually, Black Box Right on Time was actually big when I was first hitting the clubs.
Yeah. Around the same vintage, but slightly after, was every time I'd get excited. This was the one where I'd scream at the bar. It was Pink's, Get the Party Started. And so then, I'm coming up. Perfect. So you better get the party started.
I remember that one.
Yeah.
Da, 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 da,
absolute da, da. Screamer of a nightclub.
Yeah.
Song. And that should hopefully shed some light on our difference in eras when we're having this conversation.
So while I was actually mentioning that we were both
I just wanted to talk about
90s,
our party
but
songs, but yeah.
I know. But, you know, like, so both of us, I think, even though we don't necessarily have the 90s drinking in common, we've both got the binge drinking in common.
Oh, yeah, we've got the 90s binge drinking culture in common.
Exactly. So, you know, like while I was drinking to suppress whatever I could whenever I needed to, we've ascertained that you also had a binge drinking relationship. So what formed that for you?
You know, I think a lot of that was probably peer pressure and expectation. I didn't really have anything to drink until I turned 18. And even when I started uni, I don't know if it's a Queensland thing, if they let us into primary school earlier or whatnot, but when I first went to uni, I was 17. And so I was at uni for pretty much almost 6 months while everybody else was out drinking.
Oh.
I was the 17-year-old who actually wasn't drinking. And being a little bit of a stickler for the rules at the time, I was a good girl. I didn't want to good girl. And that's a whole other episode in that. But I didn't want to rock that good girl image. So I actually didn't drink anything more than just a sip here or there to just, you know, taste it.
Just to be social.
Until my 18th.
Yeah.
In which Passion Pop.
Oh.
You can taste it just by you just hear the words Passion Pop. You can taste it, right?
It's Passion Pop, I suppose, I did taste the Passion Pop when I went to university because, you know, that was the drink du jour because it was affordable.
Cheap, yeah. Cheap and sweet.
When I was entering that age, I suppose, when I was 16, Tropicana was big. I remember getting drunk when I was about 16 at my brother's, I think it was his 21st birthday party, it must have been. And I didn't mean to get drunk, but, mum and dad let me have a couple of sips of Tropicana and, woof, I was the life of the party.
I turned up to a, I was invited to like a party once. This is in the early, like I must have been under 21 or so when this was happening. And you had to bring a six pack or something. And I bought a six pack of West Coast coolers.
Oh no.
Because I liked them. And
well, that was the thing.
I was consistently made fun of that with that group of friends. I think for decades to come, that my idea of a big drink was a West Coast cooler, which was pretty much almost no booze and just a lot of sugar.
Well, you know, I'm actually known these days. If we go to a barbecue and we're told to take drinks, I don't drink normally, but if I do, I don't want to drink anything too heavy, but I will get the vodka mudslides.
Yeah, okay.
Because I love that sweetness. That's what it's about for me. It's about the flavour and the sweetness for me. And I don't like to drink hard liquor as such. I like to have a bit of flavour, a bit of depth to it, you know, like like a cocktail. I do like a cocktail.
So those, for me, those eras of, I would call it binge drinking because I never had just one drink, right? I never just came home from uni and said, hey, I'm just going to have a passion pop tonight to relax. Just one. I'm just going to...
Just going to crack open one bottle.
I'm just going to sit down in front of the TV and just have a passion pop and, you know, with my dinner to relax.
Can you imagine that scene? Hi, honey, I'm home. It's okay, sweetie, I've got your passion pop ready. Here you go, just the one.
Just the one passion pop.
I know how much you like it cold when you come in from work.
That was never what I did. So what I did was what I think almost everybody else that I went to uni with at the time did, which was not just one passion pop. It was one bottle of passion pop followed by another bottle, drunk in quick succession on a Saturday night before the club lockout time, you know, like when you, I think it was like if you weren't in by 10 o'clock, then you couldn't get in or something like that. Yep. And you had to get drunk beforehand because you were poor and drinking passion pop.
Yeah, yeah.
And you couldn't really buy much there. Yeah, it's that consuming a lot of alcohol in a very short amount of time.
Often gamified as well.
Gamified.
Drinking
yes.
games.
Yes.
You're playing drinking games. So, and the game was always such that, you know, it involved maybe a tongue twister or something or some kind of thing where you had to keep a rhythm or something. And if you dropped it, then you had to scull. So the more you sculled, obviously, the more you dropped, and then you had to scull some more. So they were rigged, obviously, to make you drink more.
I'd say that our drinking games involved vodka jello shots, except I don't think that happened until many years later because we couldn't afford vodka. passion pop jello shots aren't quite the same thing. The thing about this is that there's a lot of great experiences that came out of this, right? Like that you have some friends, you have some drinks, it's fun, you have that gamifying, you go out for a dance. There's a lot of positive memories that I still have of times that I went out with people in that situation. However, however, there are also a lot of terrible memories that I have of that situation because when you binge drink like that, when it's not just one glass of passion pop when you get home from work, it doesn't take many glasses till you've lost all that inhibition. Mm-hmm. So you lose control, I think, of a few things. You lose control of your inside voice.
Yes.
Your ability to regulate the words that are coming out of your mouth. I call it Louise Uncensored.
I've seen Louise Uncensored.
Where Louise Uncensored thinks she's saying something quietly to somebody and she's actually screaming exactly what she thinks of people to other people where they can hear it.
And suddenly people are shuffling away.
And then the next day at work I'm having to justify why I did or didn't say that thing about somebody. That's a story for another time or maybe later in the episode. The other thing that I think happens is besides, okay, the next day, you feel like shit, right?
Oh, totally.
Next day, 100%, whatever you were drinking the night before, if you binge drink, you feel like shit.
I always felt terrible after that as well. Like, not just because I felt like shit, but felt like that I was wasting the day.
The other thing that used to happen, which is probably how this ties more into negative mental health for me, is because the alcohol would cause that sort of lack of control. It didn't just affect, you know, inside voice. It also affected my ability to control my own thoughts. And so what would be at the start of the night, the best night ever, we're going out for a drink and a dance, could very easily flip if someone said something or if I thought something or if it got to 3 a.m. dregs and nobody had hit on me, could and did flip to a breakdown, I suppose. A drunken, I can't control my emotions and I can't intellectually reason with myself and nobody else can intellectually reason with me because my brain is poisoned. A breakdown on a park bench about my life, having a breakdown in the gutter about something. And that is a horrible place to be.
I'm guessing this wasn't a one-off, you know, like this is something that I'm assuming happened over a prolonged period and many times. So did you have a sense that the alcohol might have had something to do with it, or that something like under the way you used alcohol had something to do with it?
I think not for a long time. The fact that everybody used alcohol, and when I describe having, you know, those flip moments where you go from best night to crying in the gutter, I wasn't the only one that had that happen. You know, plenty of times I'd be out with a friend, it's 3 a.m., we're on the walk home, and then, you know, she sits down in a park and starts crying about her life. So
The owner of the kebab shop is probably the next best counsellor after the barman.
Kebab shop has seen it all.
And I did say barman, and I'm sorry.
Bar person.
But we are talking 90s. The barkeep.
The bartender doesn't care because they can't hear. They just keep serving you the drinks.
That's right. They just smile and not take your money.
Just take your money. We've discussed in the podcast before my long-term struggles with depression and anxiety and how I didn't really become aware of my patterns around that until, I suppose, recently. Yeah, young Louise was nowhere near self-actualized enough to see that alcohol was a contributing factor, not to causing the depression and anxiety, but to exacerbating it. So I think the removal of inhibitions through the alcohol itself probably meant that my mind didn't have that ability that I had been having to sort of compartmentalize and almost like detach, dissociate from those feelings of, you know, depression, anxiety that I was experiencing in my life because
you just go and have to have a bit of fun. That's what people that age do. We go out and have a drink and have a bit of fun, and then suddenly, for whatever reason, we're having a really bad time of it and don't know why.
But then, you know, next week when your friend says, hey, let's go out again, you remember 3 a.m. in the gutter, but you also remember it was a good time. And it's even my boring friends. It's a terrible way of putting it.
Hi, boring friends. Thanks for listening.
Even my what you would call boring friends, my bookworm, you know.
Conservative. Types, yeah.
I have a friend who is now an archivist, and I hope she doesn't listen to me call her a boring friend. But, okay, she's not boring, but I mean, when you think archivist, you don't think party animal, right?
Correct, yeah.
But even my air quotes boring friends drank every weekend. So who was there to spend time with that wasn't a part of that culture? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And the world has changed since the 90s too. You know, like I was meeting new friends on ICQ back then. And that was the only way to meet people outside your immediate sphere. You know, like you made friends with the people who were around you, who were around you because you didn't have access to anybody else. But now you could find someone that had a shared interest. You could find them through a meetup group. You could find them through a Discord. You could find them anywhere else. But ICQ was like...
That was the thing. That was the place to be. I actually started chatting to people on IRC, which was the precursor to ICQ. Oh. So on the internet relay chat.
Uh-oh.
Exactly. And don't think that I wasn't in the computer lab until 5 a.m. thinking, where the hell's the time gone?
I love that any listeners of ours that are under the age of 40 are not going to know what that sound means.
No.
That's an in-joke for your parents, guys. That is.
There you go.
So that early binge drinking culture, I think where I picked up those habits, definitely based around that. So when Marie talks about 18 years for someone to get help, imagine if I had continued with that culture. I didn't continue with that binge drinking culture. That was something that I stopped doing on my own. But I could see how you could get to be, because that would have been close to 18 years ago for me. You could get to be, you know, 40 now and then go, oh, that's where I picked up all these fucking bad habits. This idea that you've got to drink to have fun.
So what was it that made you stop using alcohol like that?
I used to joke that I don't drink to drink, I drink to get drunk. And I want to say, like, I would never consider myself at all anywhere near the scope of alcoholic. I mean, at uni and those first few years of what I'd call young adult life, absolutely every weekend there was drinking involved.
But you weren't coming home every day having a passion pop.
No, I didn't. I actually, I've never been someone who gets to the end of the day and has a stressful day and has a passion pop. I understand why people do that. It never was something that I was interested in. It was, we drink to get drunk. What's the point of it if it's not to get drunk? What's the point of just having one glass of wine or one glass of passion pop? We drink to get drunk.
Well, you know, it's the pretext for a lot of New Year's events pre-COVID, isn't it? You go out, you get drunk, you have a good time, and then you don't have a good time.
So I think when I started working, believe it or not, after I left uni and I got my first job in Canberra, I actually think that I drank more in Canberra in that first job than I ever did at uni.
Wow.
So maybe it was because I had disposable income and I no longer had to drink the passion pop, which was great because at some point in uni after a very large night, I had severely thrown up on the passion pop. And I shit you not, I could not touch anything passion flavoured for about a decade.
You know, up until that point, I was going to say to you, we should get a sponsorship from Passion Pop, but I think you just killed it.
Even now, someone says, hey, would you like a passion flavoured thing? And my stomach kind of goes,
Yeah, I'm a bit like that with Opal Nera.
I'm like that. Also like that with garlic bread after I had the great gastro of 2019. Now, garlic bread is such a shame because I really used to love garlic bread.
So when you left uni and that peer pressure wasn't there anymore, did the binge drinking stop?
No. So when I was at uni, it was to connect with people. That was the only social way to do it. When I was in places like Canberra, I used to work shift work. I'd work, you know, 10 days on, 4 days off. Mm. And my social circle was really limited to the people that I worked with. And it was a real workplace culture thing to go out together and bond and have a lot to drink. Those times that I was in Canberra and I was going out and binge drinking and then still crying in the gutter, it's just in crying in the Canberra gutter instead of the Wagga gutter.
Yeah, you didn't have a major essay due. You had some other project due for work instead.
They also coincided with some of the more depressed times in my life because, if we go back to episode... If you want to go back to episode 3, there was that moment where I was, you know, sitting on the floor of the shower with the suicidal ideations. I think when I was drinking in that time period and binge drinking, when my mind was flipping so easily, it was coming up to the surface very quickly and very easily how I was really feeling about myself and my life when I drank. So it might seem like a good idea and to belong to that workplace culture to go along to these things and to drink, especially because the first part of it is fun. But that underlying sense of depression and worthlessness very quickly and easily would come about.
So is it the moment you decided to stop?
Binge drinking? Nah. You would think that I'd learned by then. That was the moment that I slowed down. So instead of doing it every weekend, every time I had a weekend, I started working on other things. I started working on, you know, I want to get into radio and doing other things with my time. So it wasn't happening as often. But I still had that mentality of we drink to get drunk. The difference is it wasn't happening every week. And I continued to carry that mentality. The moment where I said no more binge drinking is unfortunately not as young Louise. It's really Louise of only like the last 8 years, I reckon.
Yeah, right.
We were at a work party. It was an after party for the Commercial Radio Awards and I was already really, really drunk. Then
I have seen you really, really drunk, so I can picture this. But
and then someone said, last drinks, bar's closing, so you can stay here because we'd paid for the venue. You can stay here, but we're not allowed to serve after this time. And so someone bought a bottle of vodka over the table, the pouring bottle that the bar staff are supposed to have with a little nozzle on the top, right? So we could all pour our own drinks. Louise didn't pour her own drink. Louise poured the bottle of vodka down her throat.
Oh, my God. What?
And I sculled, I think, a third of a bottle of vodka.
Whoa.
And I put it down after everyone was cheering. I think, I don't know, I mean, I've got no perception of time because I essentially poisoned myself. I said, that was a mistake. And I walked over to the toilet and I started hurling so bad that one of the new staff, you know, he'd been working for us for a little while, he's like, grabbed my phone and called my partner.
Welcome, I'm Louise.
And this is how we got to know me. Grabbed my phone, called my partner, got him to pick me up. and walked me down. Anyway.
I mean, we're laughing, but that's really quite a serious scene.
Look, 100%, never do that. Okay, the moment that I said never again was when the next morning I woke up surrounded by a couple of cheeseburgers that I had made him take me to the drive-thru and get. One was in my hand, half eaten. I woke up in a bed of cheeseburger wrappers. And when I opened my eyes, I couldn't see right. Everything had a white film over it. And I looked around and I got up and I was really woozy and the white film didn't go away. I was genuinely concerned at that point that I might have poisoned myself.
Mm, probably did.
It took me about, I think it was 2 or 3 days before my eyesight went back to normal. I was obviously vomiting the next few days. And that was the moment where, I don't think so.
Yeah.
Like, no. No more. I don't want to do this anymore.
Marie was talking as well about how, you know, alcohol is very commonly used as the social lubricant and we go out and have a bit of fun, but it does kind of go over that edge. Like, you know, when I was in uni, I drank so much one night that I passed out and they shaved off one of my eyebrows. I had no idea. They took stuff out of my room. Thankfully, they were also responsible after having their fun with me and they made sure that I didn't choke. But that could have ended, you know, with me dead. To be honest, because I could have actually asphyxiated.
I mean, a part of me does want to laugh at the eyebrow thing, but...
It was pretty funny at the time. It was embarrassing for me, but my 3-year-old niece at the time thought it was amazingly funny.
Yeah. I mean, and that part of me that does want to laugh at that also remembers feeling, like, so drunk myself that... Okay. This has taken a turn. But sexual activity... Mm-hmm. That I wouldn't have consented to if I was sober.
Mm-hmm.
So the fact that you are passed out and to the point where someone can shave your eyebrow off is a place where you lose all of your own control.
Completely.
Anybody could have done anything to you. And in some of those drinking moments, it's like, this is, okay, like a horrible turn for the conversation here. This is not where I thought it was going. But one night... I was so drunk and hadn't eaten that I only had sex with somebody because I thought they would rape me if I didn't. And I thought that was a better option than being raped, is half consenting to it.
Holy shit.
That's how the conversation goes.
And it was because you were in that vulnerable state of being drunk.
Yeah.
Which, you know, is...
Vulnerable state. I'm drunk. I haven't got any... control. I'm isolated. I don't want the situation, but saw it escalating.
And thought that that was the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
That's
because I could just get it really done and get it over with quicker if I did that instead. Yeah. There's two things to obviously that admission is that one, it shouldn't matter what state someone is in alcoholically.
No, absolutely. It shouldn't. No.
You know,
you don't go raping people.
No. Yeah. So, it shouldn't matter. And if someone looks like they are so drunk that they couldn't actually give informed consent, then it's not consent. And also, the other thing is, you know, I'm not saying that I deserved that situation or anybody deserves that situation if they're drinking. And so, the onus needs to be on you not to drink so it doesn't happen. I just mean that poor binge drinking choices that can lead to you feeling out of control and powerless.
Yeah, okay. So here's another example that doesn't involve sexual exploitation or rape. So
grey area sexual assault, yeah?
Yeah, yeah. So to furnish the example in a different way that you know, isn't about sex, there was one night where I got drunk with some friends at a house party and we got very drunk and we had driven to the party and it was time to go home and I hopped in the car with a drunk driver.
Yeah.
And you know, I never drive drunk and I shouldn't have hopped into that car. And thank God the ditch we kind of rolled into wasn't steeper because that could have, again, ended up in very serious injury or death. But we ended up taking a curve too quickly and we had to crawl out of the car because it had rolled down into a ditch. When we drink too much, when we drink to excess, whether we're having fun at the time or not, there is that element of losing control.
Mm.
what makes us keep doing that? If we know that we're going to lose control, what makes us keep doing that so that we, you know, we keep going back for more? And, you know, is there a wake-up point at some point that says, got to stop?
I don't want to get out of control again. I haven't stopped drinking permanently. I just hardly ever drink now. I started from then saying, instead of we only drink to get drunk, I started saying, I only have a drink if I'm already in a good mood.
Yeah, that's a big difference. I actually started the same. You know, I really kind of cut off drinking when my mum died because I knew that if I was going to go out and have a drink with people, I would be that emotional mess because I already was. Mm. And I made a pretty firm choice then, and I've stuck to it ever since, that if I feel happy enough, I'll have a drink. And even then, I might not even want one. And that's okay. But I've become more accustomed to not having a drink than actually going out and bowing into, hey, Andy, have a drink, here you go, mate, that kind of stuff, because that doesn't work for me anymore.
I actually think once I started working on my mental health for real, once I started to realise my long-term traits of depressive episodes, anxiety, once I started to cut through the platitudes and get to the core of living authentically, I didn't need to drink. It's actually detrimental to my health. Not only does it now, would it affect the medication that I take, which makes me feel better, but there's been more negative things that have come from it than positive.
Yeah.
You know, sadly, I think that alcohol being a lot of the reason for unconsensual sex is going to be so relatable. That's fucking awful, isn't it? That,
well, because people get drunk and they get horny, and beer goggles, it's a very fucking common term as well, you know, like people get so horny that they'll just accept a fuck.
Mm.
And I think that works both ways, you know, like people regret cracking onto someone because that's where the beer goggles things really has its like genesis. But really, like a girl with beer goggles in this case doesn't feel like she can actually say no.
Yeah. I don't know if I'd call that beer goggles, but...
No, I know, it's clumsy, but you know what I'm saying, though.
I think it's that lack of
discretion that comes about because you're drunk. The lack of control, the lack of
it's the negative of vulnerability. It's, you know, it's a real grey area.
It's complete exposure,
because
basically,
if two people are affected by alcohol and one person doesn't in that situation, he was pushing for sex and you know, kissing me and pinning me and that kind of stuff. And it's like, I didn't explicitly
You know what, though?
I didn't explicitly
The way he's used
no.
alcohol there is he's actually brought out a part of his personality that he probably wouldn't do either. But let me finish the thought here, because it's not excusing his behaviour. Like, he's exposing who he really is by doing that when he's drunk. Because if he's doing it when he's drunk, he's thought about doing it when he's not drunk.
And I would back that up by saying that you're absolutely right, because when he was sober the next day, he kept pressuring me after that to see him again.
Mm.
And I said, no, I don't ever want to speak to you again.
Yeah.
And he was married and cheated on his wife.
Mm. Mm-hmm. There you go.
So, yeah. So there you go. And then the only way I got him to leave me alone was I said, if you don't leave me alone, I will tell your wife what you did.
Yeah. And then, of course, you would have been the bitch.
And you know what? Do you know what? That was younger Louise, but older Louise thinks that I probably would have fucking told her. For a start, older Louise would have punched him in the throat and told him to get the fuck out of my house.
Yeah.
I would never have been in that situation with him to begin with. And then I would have gone around and told his wife that she's wasting her life with a fucking scumbag.
Yeah. If we were kind of taught younger to kind of look out for ourselves in that way, rather than follow society's norms of have a drink, get loose, fuck around.
Because you have to wonder, is it premeditated? Is that part of his thing, you know? Bring around a bottle of wine? Because he did say he was bringing food, but then he didn't bring much in the way of food, so there wasn't much food.
Just the wine, yeah.
It's that thing that, you know, people say now, is that if it's not a clear yes, then it's a no. And
yeah.
I didn't say yes, but I didn't say no. I thought no, kind of tried to pull away. And
which should have been enough for him to go, okay, no.
And then in the end, I just said, just hurry up. The sooner we could get it over with, the sooner he could leave. I
wonder how many other people have got rape stories.
Well, most of rape is about power.
Mm.
I don't know if I'd call mine a rape story. I mean, I suppose it is a rape story.
Mm, it is.
Because there's
that. Rape's not sex. It's about control.
Yeah, but because both parties were drinking, I don't know.
No, that's apologist. Like, the him drinking and you drinking, it's no excuse for him to rape you.
Yeah, but if I didn't outwardly say no.
It's still not your fault. Like, Are you telling me that he didn't know what he was doing by bringing a bottle of wine and then by the next morning when he was sober trying to continue it anyway?
Fuck, we make apologies for shitty men.
Yeah.
I truly hate that that story is going to relate for people. I truly hate that other women that are listening to this part of the conversation are going to say, yeah, that's happened to me as well.
Well, you know, like I got catfished once very early on in the internet days.
Mm.
You know, I was doing the early version of online dating where you'd go on and you'd kind of have a chat to someone, chat each other up, you'd decide to meet. He sent these photos. He looked really cute. I drove over and nothing. It was nothing like the photographs, but I did not feel confident enough to say, look, no, I'm not going to go through with this. And I was pressured into having sex with him.
Mm. Same thing, isn't it?
It is. It's exactly the same thing.
It's a whole other episode. I had sex.
It's all about coercion. And
yeah, it's coercion. I had sex with someone once because it was his birthday and he said he was alone for his birthday. And I said, come over, I'll make you a steak. That was all it was going to be. We were just friends. But then when he was there, he was like, it's not fair that I don't get some birthday sex. And you didn't get me a birthday present, so maybe I could have some birthday sex. And then starts grabbing me.
Fucking what?
Anyway, and I'm like, yeah, okay. Because, oh, God, this is going to sound terrible. Because I did say come over for a steak, but I actually don't cook very well. So when he got there, he saw that I was struggling with it. And I thought, well, to be fair, I asked him over for a steak and I didn't cook it well and he had to cook it. So maybe I should pay him back for it. So I gave him some birthday sex and it was terrible for me and great for him. It was like a little fucking Energizer Bunny jackrabbit. It was just fucking bang, 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 bang. Done.
Happy birthday.
Awful.
Yeah.
There was no alcohol involved in that one. That was coercion via guilt, that one.
By guilt.
Yeah. It strikes me that as we're having this conversation, that relationship that I formed with alcohol when I was just starting to drink as it being not just a rite of passage, but it being fun, it being a thing that you have to do, you have to be a part of it, even though along that journey, it's resulted in some terrible experiences for me, that it's still more overwhelmingly been, but I still have to take part in alcohol culture for those almost 18 years.
You know what it is as well? It's not just that. It's just that it's my responsibility to make sure I don't get myself into those messes because, you know, how much were you blaming yourself for being raped?
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't really think about it. Like, it's not like...
Yeah.
I mean, I... That's probably something to, you know, bring up with the therapist at some point, but it's not like, I certainly know people who have been raped in what I would call a real rape way. And I don't think that's even a good way to quantify a real rape versus a thingy rape. But
no, but you know people who have been violently raped.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the difference. Yeah. Violently raped.
Because the rape's not about the sex. It's about the coercion and the control.
Yeah. And so I think in my mind have minimised that experience and chalked it up to a bad drinking experience.
But also you did say specifically that you decided to get it over with because you felt that if you resisted, he would become quite aggressive.
Yeah, I did. And I did think that because he was being aggressive with how he was trying to push me to kiss him and stuff like that. And then like literally in that situation, I even vomited and he still kept going.
Mm.
Then you know what I also did is I turned that story into a joke and I actually reframed that story into what I would call, you know, a great tale to retell at parties.
Yeah, right.
You seen Nanette with Hannah Gadsby, yeah?
Yeah.
And how she you know, she says that she made all those jokes about situations and how she told the story in one way and it sounds like a joke, but then when she tells the rest of the story, you know, the kind of being beaten up and sexually assaulted and it's not a joke, she's not the punchline.
Yeah.
I reframed that story into one that I told for ages, which was he was so bad that I said just get it over with and threw a dildo at him and et cetera, et cetera. Because that was an entertaining story.
Yeah, and one in which that you weren't actually...
And one in which I had control.
Yeah.
Yeah. So looking back on all of that, and there's some interesting food for thought in there that is, I suppose, a bit unexpectedly coming out of this episode. It certainly wasn't planned for me to say those things.
Well, that is the warts and all.
It definitely wasn't in the run sheet, was it, to talk about coercive sex? No.
No, I think it falls somewhere under the bit that says Louise explained.
It's interesting in this conversation, it does strike me that even with those stories, which are now arguably awful, not even arguably, just awful.
They're awful.
It wasn't until I had that experience where I thought I'd poisoned myself with alcohol that I actually gave it up. Turns out that, you know, coercive sex wasn't enough to rid myself of that idea of I have to be a part of drinking culture.
So after all of that, you know, it kind of would look on the surface like you just kind of went cold turkey at one point, that you just decided to give up the bottle and start living differently. And I think, you know, it's pretty rare that it's the case that someone can just go cold turkey. You know, whatever substance it is they're addicted to, whether it's alcohol or something otherwise, you know, cigarettes, hard drugs, it's pretty rare for someone to just be able to switch that off.
Yeah, and even though it's much easier to make a change when we're younger, apparently, because our brains aren't formed yet and are fully formed yet and they're more plastic, Marie did have some encouraging words for any of us in our middle or later years. I think I'm identifying as a Hermione. Is it too late for me now if I don't have a nice, fresh teenage brain with all of its extra neurons and I'm set in my routine pathways?
Oh, my golly, never too late. Never, never too late. And, you know, it's not as easy as when you're 13 and 14 or 15, but we sort of know that, don't we? We know that with most things in life, it's a lot easier to do it when you're 13, 14 and 15. But it is absolutely never too late to turn it around and to create positive coping mechanisms rather than relying on what can be short term. You know, it does make you feel better when you've had a drink. But the problem is that that quickly shifts from being a short-term positive to a long-term not positive.
Hey there. Just wanted to take a little breather from today's episode and say thank you so much for listening to us. Make sure you never miss an episode by hitting the follow button on your podcast app now. And while you're there, we'd love it if you left us a review. It really does help to boost us so we can reach even more people. You can also check out our Patreon page to see how you can access even more content at patreon.com/reframeofmind. And remember to tell everyone you know about us, because the more people we get talking about mental health, the more supported we'll all be.
Welcome to your 2023 work recap. This year, you've been to 127 Sync meetings, you spent 56 minutes searching for files, and almost missed 8 deadlines. Yikes! 2024 can and should sound different. With Monday.com, you can work together easily, collaborate and share data, files, and updates. So all work happens in one place and everyone's on the same page. Go to Monday.com or tap the banner to learn more.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
How many of your employees are trying to balance paying bills and saving for retirement? Support your participants today and tomorrow with Vanguard well on your way at institutional.vanguard.com. All investing is subject to risk. Advice provided by Vanguard Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor.
So we talked about my relationship with alcohol, and we've talked about your relationship with smoking, and we're talking about addiction and being addicted to a substance like alcohol or nicotine. I actually don't think... Hopefully, this is not one of those things where I'm going to need an intervention. I actually don't think that I was addicted to alcohol. I don't think that I was alcoholic in that way. I think I was addicted to the thought pattern that I needed to have alcohol to have a good time. I needed to do it.
Yeah.
To be a part of Australian culture.
Let's face it, like, we're sold those messages all the time, aren't we? We have prime ministers that go out to the cricket and booze on and, you know, give that that thumbs up saying, yeah, do this, have a go out and have fun. It's,
yeah.
It's something that's almost expected of us.
So because I wasn't going home every night and having a passion pop with my TV after a stressful day, I don't think it was, I have to have this thing, which I think is different than it was for you with nicotine, because that very much is a physiological craving. So how did you actually quit smoking?
There came a time where I decided that I definitely needed to, because, you know, talk through these things that we've been talking through, there does come that point where we kind of know that, okay, this has to stop. So whether it's that relationship you have with binge drinking or whether it's me with the nicotine, I knew that for my own health and even socially, because smoking, you know, has become a lot less common, but I wanted to quit. I wanted to give it up. So I actually then came across an app that was produced by Quit SA at the time. And I remember years before when I had tried to quit, and I had almost like, I guess, a paper version of something to keep you motivated along all the different points of giving up. So basically they would set out a calendar over the first 30 days of your quit journey and say, you know, by this stage your lungs are doing this, and by this stage you're doing that, and by this stage you've reduced that and something else, which, you know, that's the sort of stuff that I can relate to kind of keep me motivated with the goals of it. So the app from Quit SA was actually quite a similar kind of tactic. And so I had the app, and it was sending me little reminders of encouragement every now and then of, you know, you've not smoked for this long, congratulations. And even though it wasn't a person doing that, it actually was enough of a reminder that I'd gone this long without cigarettes and my body was actually repairing, that it was actually recovering. And I guess, you know, there are a lot of studies out to maybe how much damage is permanent and I shouldn't have smoked in the first place and all that kind of stuff, but that's not the point. Like, when you're giving up smoking, it's hard.
Yeah.
You know, when you're giving up anything like that, it's bloody hard. And any little sign of encouragement, not negative reinforcement, but encouragement, for me anyway, is the thing that really helped me to actually then stop altogether in 2012. It's 10 years in April since I've had a cigarette.
So as Marie points out, technology does play a vital role in providing evidence-based information for people to access in a non-judgmental way.
I think that is where there is incredible power about making some of those first connections through mediums like digital mediums. So I just really encourage people. There are evidence-based sources of information, and it's reaching out to those. You know, our website's called Cracks in the Ice, for example, for methamphetamine. It's reaching out for those and going to those trusted evidence-based resources, because there is a lot of stigma.
I wonder if that's a risk sometimes of us falling into a trap of toxic positivity, where somebody will say something that for them works. Do we really need to start looking more into what we're saying and how we say it and how that might be supporting us or otherwise?
I really love that term, toxic positivity.
We'll get it printed on a t-shirt.
Wow. I think let's chuck out toxic positivity and toxic negativity, and let's talk about greater compassion. So, you know, it's being self-compassion and compassion to others. So I do love that toxic positivity. Makes me want to throw it out, but it's toxic positivity.
I think we've found the subject of your next research paper.
I know, exactly.
I'm kind of proud we introduced Marie to the concept of toxic positivity.
Yeah, she really loved that term, didn't she?
She wanted to throw it out, but she loved the name for it.
Yeah. Look, I mean, a common theme that started cropping up ever since we spoke to Nathan Parker way back in episode 6 is that we need to look for one small thing.
Yeah, Nathan was our guest who wanted to be a fighter pilot since he was a kid, but then was in a bus accident where he had to have his hand amputated, and then had to teach himself to, well, function and fly again every day by making small choices. That was his philosophy.
Yeah, so this is really the first time that together we heard this concept of, I suppose, what other people might call chunking, you know, so where you look for something small that's manageable that you can use to move towards the change that you want. And, you know, people do communicate that in different ways. You know, we hear it when we're ready to hear it, I suppose, is what that comes down to.
The advice I really loved from Marie was that concept of letting ourselves do social experiments to see how we feel when we're trying a modified behaviour.
I'd like to think that eventually we can get to the sophisticated space where we can actually have work events where we don't have to have alcohol. associated with them. But, you know, that's a bit of a way off. It's both individuals, so having those skills and testing it yourself. Like, can I go to the party, not drink, and still have fun? And that's a great behavioural experiment that you can run with yourself. Maybe you don't have to do it every party, but you try it for one or two parties and test. Do what we call behavioural experiment, which is go to the party, see what your behaviour is like without the alcohol. You might enjoy it. I think, you know, we were just talking about that. Mm. Sometimes it actually can be more fun to do that. And then it's also being around peers and having the conversations with them that maybe this is what you're going to choose to do, and then gathering strength. You'll be surprised how many other peers will also be thinking that that's something that they might like to try. We'll have an experiment and see whether we can actually have fun without drinking.
Well, I can happily say that I've never felt like a cigarette, even with everything that's happened in the last 2 years.
And I don't drink to cope anymore. Now I take prescription medication.
But you're not addicted.
No, well, I might be addicted. No, now I cope with things by actually looking at my feelings and talking to a psychologist and getting to the bottom of what's going on. And I think that's actually a lot more healthy.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it is definitely possible to overcome addictions, and even if it does involve more than a, you know, you've just got to do this, or you've got this, just do it.
Just do it.
That kind of platitude.
You can do it.
You got this, boo. Maybe I have, maybe I haven't. But, you know, there's always a lot that's underneath that band-aid of a platitude.
So when we initially reached out to Marie, we wanted to explore whether our behaviours are actually embedded in habits that can also be seen as addictive. You know, when we want to do something, but we can't, and then we beat ourselves up on it for not being able to.
And Marie pointed us towards what she termed as the 6 big risk factors for adolescence.
We talk about them as the big 6 risk factors for poor health in adolescence. So alcohol, tobacco, sleep, sugar intake, physical activity, and screen time. And they are big 6 risk factors for poor health in adolescents, and you can switch it around knowing this information to actually increase healthy behaviours, not just decrease.
I'm really interested that you actually included sugar as a part of the big 6 there. It's something that we don't often think about as far as addiction goes.
Yeah, so the sugar, and, you know, in terms of a risk factor for poor health, and sugar intake is absolutely one of the big 6.
It's really interesting to hear sugar identified in one of the big 6.
Yeah, I am a big sugar addict. I have been since I can ever remember. I've always had a sweet tooth, as it's nicely termed, but there have been times when I've gone off it and then it takes just one little bit of something with a bit of sugar, and Andy is eating a family-sized block of chocolate within 2.5 minutes again.
Can I tell you that when we put the run sheet for this episode together, I think it planted this idea and this sugar idea in my head. Last night I actually had dreams I was eating M&Ms. And I think I was eating like a packet of M&Ms, and then I don't know if it was you or someone that could be you but didn't look like you in the dream saying, "Don't do it. Don't eat the M&Ms. You'll ruin your out of sugarness," or whatever you said. And I just kept getting another packet of M&Ms. So, I mean, that's how I felt in my dream, because I don't have refined sugar now. It is. I want to say, because the first thing that people think when I say something like, "I don't eat refined sugar," is, "Oh, you want to lose weight."
Hmm.
Not at all. I'm happy being me. I'm happy being fat. I'm all good for that. I am a plus size queen and proud of it. I don't eat sugar because I have chronic pain, and sugar leads to inflammation that's worse. Refined sugar that leads to inflammation that's worse. And I'm got sick of having chronic pain. And so, much like any other lots of other things I've tried in my life, like going gluten-free and not eating dairy, cutting out sugar was a part of that.
How's the chronic pain since you gave it up?
Still there. Better. It's not as bad. Not gone. Mm. Just not as bad. So earlier in the episode, I said I didn't think I was addicted to alcohol. It was just I was addicted to the thoughts and the culture.
Mm.
100% addicted to sugar. I was 100% addicted to sugar. Actually giving up sugar, refined sugar. I will say refined sugar, because I actually do still have things like coconut sugar, maple syrup, anything that is kind of a slower burning, lower GI thing. And that's to do with the way that cane sugar spikes in your blood, or and rice sugar actually is a I'm not a scientist, and this is also not a dietary podcast, so you might need to consult actual information here.
Dietary advice. Yeah, we'll add that to the disclaimer at the front.
Talk to an actual dietitian about this. but like, okay, one of the vegan sugars that is often in things is rice sugar, but rice sugar is really high GI, so it acts very similar to cane sugar.
Okay.
That is important information for this part of the conversation in my sugar discussion. But giving up refined sugar or high GI sugars, exceptionally hard because my body was definitely craving them.
Because your pleasure receptors are programmed to expect them and to want them. You're craving it.
My little dopamine hits.
Yeah.
Because it does. It causes that. Not a nutritionist, again, but it does cause that flood. You get all those good feeling chemicals, and your brain and body associates, I eat this and it causes that, but it doesn't seem to associate, I eat this, it causes that, and then 10 minutes later, because it's peaked in GI and it's made your blood sugar peak, it also causes it to drop significantly after as well, and causes that crash, you know, the afternoon crash, the sugar crash, where you need some more sugar to boost you back up. I feel like I'm starting to sound like I'm
Rosemary Stanton.
Like I'm about to sell everybody on a raw paleo diet or something like that. Like I'm about to push some kind of course on somebody, and I swear I'm not.
Some kind of crash diet.
Yeah. Like I'm about to advocate for a detox tea or some shit like that. But I'm not. But okay, sugar is in almost every processed food that we eat. It is super hard to kick an addiction to sugar because it's not just about, I won't just have a chocolate bar. It's also about, I've got to rearrange my lifestyle so that I don't even have that loaf of bread because that particular loaf of bread has sugar in it.
Remember that time when that large hamburger chain was told they couldn't actually call their buns bread rolls because they had too much sugar and were therefore confectionery?
Yes, things like that. We end up in this position as people, as a society, because we're time poor and we're out of energy, and so it's easy to go to the supermarket and pick up something that's pre-prepared and ready to go. Completely valid because we don't have the time or the energy. But then the thing that's in that food, you know, it might have a lot of sugar in it, which makes it taste great, but then that spikes the blood sugar and then it crashes later, and then we don't have the energy because we've experienced a crash in our GI and our blood sugar, and then we have something else to compensate for the crash, and then we go up for a bit and then we crash. It's like, it's similar to the coffee effect, I think. You know, you start off your morning with that coffee and you get the caffeine rush. And then once it's done, boom, you feel like a zombie walking and you need another one.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, you know, what you're saying there really is that like any of these things, even with sugar, it's not just a simple case of saying, cut it out, don't do it, because there's a lot of things you need to keep your eye on to actually help you not do it.
Yeah, there's all the kind of the infrastructure, like, we don't exist in a vacuum, Andy.
We don't. No, as much as we would like to sometimes, we don't.
And we say this about mental health all the time because, you know, the world around us affects our mental health, and we need to acknowledge, you know, we don't exist in a vacuum and work the best way we can in the world that we live in. And the same thing goes for things like physical health or physical addiction. I'm sure that if we were Gwyneth Paltrow and we could afford our own personal chefs to follow us around and make our organic, free-range vegan salads, then we would all probably be a lot healthier.
Maybe, but, you know, I look at some of those diets and they have treats in there based on the ingredients that are, inverted commas, safe, and they're just replicating those old things like have a keto-friendly bounty bar. Sure, I will. Thank you. I don't know. I think that there's a whole lot of reprogramming and retraining with the palate that needs to kind of go on there as well, because I don't want to be one of those people that say you should never ever have a bounty bar because I love bounty bars. But
are you becoming a nutritionist like I was?
I think so. Yeah. But I think, you know, like if we're going to look at changing our eating habits, I think those sorts of replacement ones or substitutes, if you want to go down that vegan pathway with the Gwyneth Paltrow type chef, I think those replacements are a good stepping stone to finding your way to that new way of eating. But to me, when I reach for sugar, there's something else behind it.
Mm-hmm.
Similarly with the cigarettes, when I want a chocolate bar, it's because I'm feeling stressed about something, or it's really because I really feel like a good bit of chocolate, because I can eat compound chocolate and get that same feeling of satisfaction. You know, I've been known to raid the pantry here for cooking chocolate because we haven't had any other chocolate left in the house. So it's something else. It's not the chocolate. It's something else. So by replacing sweet for a different type of sweet, I suppose, you know, from a mental health point of view, if we're, because this is what we're talking about here in this podcast, we're talking about the things we do because of how we're feeling. So for me, like I went out and bought a bunch of chocolate, some nice chocolate last night because, you know, it's nice to have some nice chocolate.
Always good to treat yourself.
I had, exactly. The short-term benefit of that is amazing because it tastes so nice. Yeah. The longer term benefit of that last night was that I was awake for 3 or 4 hours with the worst heartburn because that particular chocolate does give me heartburn. You know, I love it so much. So, you know, when Marie talks about trading off the short-term benefits to the long-term impacts, then when it comes to chocolate, I'm really, really bad at that. I used to be bad at it with cigarettes, but I'm bad at it with sugar still.
Yeah. Well, I mean, if we're lacking something in our mental health, I think whether it's, I suppose, an emotional thing like that whole idea where we eat our feelings.
Mm.
And I think there's something to be said for that because I would certainly, and still do, reach for a big old plate of potatoes with butter if I'm feeling empty inside emotionally. That's my eating of feelings. You know, it's a whole other conversation to talk about potatoes and carbohydrates converting to sugar, which again, not a nutritionist, but it's a similar process. And I think so there's that part of eating your feelings. A lot of that messaging comes through media and advertising that we've grown up with, you know, like think about, it's not the only example, but what about Bridget Jones's Diary? When we see her at a point where she's depressed, she's curing that depression by drinking and smoking and eating sugar and, you know, all those kind of things. So part of it we pick up is that. But I think the other part of it is that physiological thing with those elements of sugar. If we're deficient in dopamine or other feel-good chemicals, then our body does crave it and says, you're lacking in dopamine, go have a bounty.
Also, I remember like food is another one of those things that we are trained to use for comfort or to make things better. You know, like alcohol is, oh, have a drink, mate, you'll be fine. My first day of kindergarten, I vividly remember I was so upset. Oh my God, I had separation anxiety from mum because I hadn't gone to preschool or anything like that. So it was a massive culture shock the first day. I was one of those kids that cried. And I remember, luckily, thankfully, you know, one of my very good friends was in my kindergarten class. And I remember we were sitting on the mat and I was crying. I was trying hard not to cry because boys don't cry. But I was upset. And she reached over and she said, Andrew, look, have these biscuits that your mum made for little lunch. They'll make you feel better.
Mm.
And so through my tears, I ate the biscuits and I didn't feel better. But now when I want to feel better, I eat something.
Did I tell you about my duck Daffy that went to go live on a farm?
Yeah, I have heard the Daffy story, but for the benefit of our listeners.
I was, I remember moving house in between year 3 and 4 and it was at the first house we lived in. So I was definitely under year 3, whatever that age is. And I had a duck called Daffy and it's this beautiful big white duck. Might have been a gander, actually.
A drake,
that's the one. Because it got a little bit aggressive sometimes and would nip my ankles and I'd have to like jump up on top of the swing set to get away from it. And so I had a love-hate relationship with Daffy, the duck. I did love the duck. I didn't love my ankles being bitten.
Yeah.
And one day I came home from school. Mum said, look, we've had to, you know, we've taken Daffy. Daffy needed somewhere else to live that he had more space. He nips and he bites and things like that. So we've taken him to go live on a farm.
Oh.
And I was inconsolable, sad, because I didn't want Daffy to go away just because he nipped me. I love Daffy.
No.
And so to ease my pain, they gave me a can of Coke, which I'm not calling up bad parenting, but like back then Coke was, I mean, we weren't a Coke drinking family. We were an AC Cola drinking family. We couldn't afford so Coke.
Coke was the premium.
Coke was the premium. And I remember, you know, getting a couple of cans of Coke then and, you know, here you go, have this to feel better. And it did. It made me feel better because I got a thing that I hardly ever was allowed to have, like the premium thing. And so it's not that it took the grief about Daffy going to live on the farm away, but much like you, your story with the cookies, how one of those formative experiences of, here you go, we eat sweets to feel better.
Yeah.
Can contribute to things.
Yeah.
And yes, I was about 26 at the Royal Easter Show when Mum called while I was there. She said, what are you doing? I said, I'm at the Easter Show just looking at the ducks. And she said, oh, you mean like Daffy? I said, yeah, my duck who went to go live on a farm. And she went, Daffy died. We just told you that.
Oh.
I didn't know.
Daffy bought the farm.
It was 26. Aww. I didn't realise.
Oh.
Anyway.
Well, at least you didn't say we ate Daffy for dinner that night. That would have been a whole lot of the story.
Oh, that guilt I carried that Daffy had to leave because he nipped my ankles and he died and he never went to go live on a farm.
Oh.
Another
Hello, sugar addiction.
Another unexpectedly sad story to come out of today's episode.
Awesome.
But yeah, okay. So we do food as comfort. We are trying to fix our mental health with things that aren't actually looking at our mental health. It's like we're doing the best that we can as people to compensate for how we feel, but often we're not being self-aware enough to recognise that how we feel has more going on than what we think.
Yeah. And so, you know, like when we're coming back to a mental health context, you know, we try to change things, you know, like earlier we said about Nathan Parker looking for one small thing that can make a difference. We try to make small changes that we can sustain.
Mm.
So we've talked, I don't know whether in a previous episode or not, but we've certainly talked between you and I about how I approach the laundry and how, okay, well.
Yes, we have a Kimberly Norris episode for reference if anyone wants to go back.
There we go.
Yeah.
So, you know, like there's a massive pile there, but it's just going to keep growing if I don't at least do one. So I put in a small load and then I walk away and do something else that I actually want to do. But having taken that small step to do that one small load of washing, and that's a sustainable change for me because I can actually think of that as a small task then, not as this big mountain of laundry. So that then, you know, helps me to reprogram the way I look at things and to make those kind of small adjustments to help me get off my own back about things in other ways.
Yeah, I think that to reprogram a behaviour that we're doing, to use that word, the goal or the payoff has to be better than what we're getting. So we have to find a way to, for you, I suppose, if you can keep it in your mind that feeling of being on top of your laundry is better than that feeling of always being overwhelmed by it, it can help you make that change because that payoff in that feeling is better.
Yeah, you know, the payoff for me is that I haven't got people complaining to me they haven't got something fresh to wear. I would much rather
You haven't got people. How many people do you live with, Andy?
That's just myself and my partner and the two cats. Mm-hmm. The cats admittedly don't have much to say about it.
They don't wear pants.
They don't wear pants. They certainly don't wear the pants in the family. So it's all those things about not having to have those conversations about where's this or where's that. Like it's done. It's not even an issue.
Yeah.
Because I work from home as well, you know. So for me to be able to incorporate pieces of the housework into my day as well is really useful because it means that before we log on and do things of a morning, I can put a load of washing through and it's fine. It's such a small part of my day overall, but it is a massive contribution to, you know, what could potentially be an argument down the track because a shirt's not available or me having to contend with a massive pile of laundry and spend a day doing it or attending to it rather than just half hour here or there.
And that sugar thing for me in terms of kicking sugar as an addiction, because there is that physiological side of it. When I first said, no, I'm going to stop having refined sugar, it was about 4 weeks before I stopped having the overwhelming cravings to have it. I couldn't go near a supermarket and walk anywhere near a confectionery aisle because my body was just screaming at me, eat the sugar. Eat the sugar, just one bit of sugar. It's not going to hurt. Just one bit of sugar.
Because just get a small chocolate bar.
Exactly. It's just a little bit. Just have a little bit. Just one more. Just one more piece.
Mm.
It's physiological. Like your body gets addicted to it. It gets addicted to getting those hits of dopamine, et cetera, through it. And then it's going, why have you stopped giving me this thing that I need? And it's like the thought about having sugar was literally clouding. It was clouding my mind. It was like I'd just be sitting there thinking, want something sweet, need sugar, need sugar, need sugar. The only thing I think that made it sustainable for me is that even though my body was craving sugar, the inflammation in my joints was feeling better.
Mm.
And so the goal there was actually the fact that I felt better is worth more than that dopamine hit from the sugar. It's worth ignoring those cravings, that voice in me that's screaming out for a chocolate bar, because my wrists don't hurt as more. My ankles don't hurt as much, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm not waking up with headaches anymore because, you know, sugar dehydrates you. So I think that that reward to overcome an addiction, I think that that long-term reward has to be worth it.
Oh, it definitely has to outweigh the short-term goal. Yeah, the short-term payoff.
For a change to be sustainable, that long-term impact, that long-term goal, it has to be big. It is hard. And I don't think we can do it alone. If it wasn't for, you know, friends, I have a friend who's been helping me out in the last year by doing some cooking for me and sticking stuff in the freezer so that if I, and constantly do, run out of energy, I've got something there to go to eat that is nutritious and easy instead of me getting Uber Eats because I can't control if there's sugar in that. So I don't think we can do it alone either.
Yeah, we need to make sure we put the right supports in place, whatever they are, definitely. So, you know, that's an example of making a sustainable change with the support of somebody in this case, which is awesome, you know. And it's not just about changing our mind about something, because there are other things inside that vacuum that we live in, because we don't live in a vacuum. Spoiler alert.
And even though we called the podcast Reframe of Mind, definitely takes more than just changing your mind to make changes happen.
Yeah, yeah. These changes, they do require our ongoing attention and adaptation.
And sometimes that support can come in form of people around you, and sometimes the place to get support is online, like the Matilda Centre, where Marie is from, has a heap of really good resources available.
And we've popped those onto our website as well at reframeofmind.com.au. If you look under the episode that Marie featured in last time, which is episode 14, you'll be able to access a heap of resources that Marie has kindly pointed us in the direction of.
I tell you what, we'll also stick them in episode 15 too, hey?
All right. Why not?
Yeah.
Get the IT team onto it.
The IT team. Hang on, let me go fetch the IT team. Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Hey there, Louise.
Hi. Do you want me, to go fetch the marketing team?
Sure. Hey.
Hey.
How you doing, Louise? Hang on, isn't Andy part of the marketing team as well?
Oh, yeah. Hang on. I think you should go and fetch our head of writing.
Okay. Hey, how you doing?
Anyway, so
we're a two-person show.
Someone in our team will pop those resources on reframeofmind.com.au. Next time on Reframe of Mind, we're going to bring you that interview with Tisha Rose that we promised you at the end of last episode, because we actually had a development in her story that she let us know of last week. So we paused the promised interview, dropped in this as sort of a bonus episode, and we've recorded another segment to add into that to update her story for next episode.
What we do know about Tisha Rose is that she's been living with chronic illness in the form of multiple sclerosis for over 20 years. And we had a chat to her about how she's managed her mental health in the face of chronic illness.
I'm no longer defined by MS. It's not on my mind all the time. You know, I read a story about someone with MS and I'm like, oh, that's awful. And I'm thinking, no, I've got that disease. That's me. And then so it's not there. You know, I'm not thinking about it all the time.
If you're concerned about yourself or someone you know, please seek professional advice and support. You can contact Beyond Blue on 1300 224 636 or at beyondblue.org.au.
Or you can contact Lifeline on 131114 or at lifeline.org.au. We'd like to thank today's guests for sharing their personal stories and insights. And for more information on any of the subjects, guests or references used in this episode, please see our show notes or reframeofmind.com.au.
Reframe of Mind is a Welcome Change Media production.
I had an ant farm when I was a kid.
I find ants very interesting. Like,
they're very busy, aren't they?
Fascinating, like the way they're so smart, like the way they work as a team.
Yeah, yeah.
But have you seen them when they've gotten caught in a death spiral?
No.
Because they follow the pheromones of the ant in front. So if the ant in front gets lost and they all end up following each other into a spiral until they all die of starvation.
That's sad. Sad for the ant.
You know what? They come back the next day. I'm sure ants get reincarnated the next day.
Yeah, probably a quick turnaround for an ant. the number of times they get squashed. Okay, so like you just got swatted, so back you go. Have another go. Wow.
And this is the kind of bonus content you can get on our Patreon.
Absolutely.
Tired of ads crashing your comedy podcast party? Good news. Ad-free listening on Amazon Music is included with your Prime membership. Just head to amazon.com/adfreecomedy to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Enjoy thousands of Acast shows ad-free for Prime subscribers. Some shows may have ads.